ஓம் ஜனனியும் சாரதோரன் தேவி ராமகிருஷ்ணன் ஜெகத்குரு பாதபத்மேட்டு யோசித்து பிரணமாமி குரு. So this afternoon session, I will begin with a description of Holy Mother's last days. Especially the instruction that she gave to her disciples and the world at large. Here's a short description. It's part of the introduction written to this book, The Gospel of Holy Mother. She was now fast sinking. Mother was approaching her end, the end of her physical embodied existence in this world. 5 days before her passing, an old devotee named Mother of Annapurna was called into her room. When the lady expressed her fears about the future, the mother remarked, "Why do you fear? You have seen the Master. But I tell you one thing, if you want peace of mind, do not find fault with others. Rather, see your own faults. Learn to make the whole world your own. No one is a stranger. The whole world is your own." Perhaps this embodies her last message to the world also. Now, the profoundness of this statement can be explained, described in several volumes. So, Swami Vivekananda, in his Inspired Talks, makes a statement which he repeats in Practical Vedanta, in his writing on Practical Vedanta. "The infinite oneness of the soul is the eternal sanction of all morality, all ethics, all good actions." So, here Swamiji interprets Vedanta, especially non-dualistic Advaita Vedanta, as the highest universal ethical philosophy. Because Advaita looks upon the whole humanity as the expression of one spiritual principle, the entire humanity as one spiritual family. So there is no otherness, there is not the other. The whole humanity is looked upon as one spiritual entity. The idea explained in Swamiji's lectures and even in scriptures, ancient scriptures, is put here by Mother as not seeing other people's faults and learning to make the whole world our own, looking upon the whole world, humanity, as one spiritual family. Well, just to give you an idea of the profoundness of this statement, I can just quote from the ancient Sanskrit scripture with Shankaracharya's commentary. There is a statement in the Mandukya Karika, which is a commentary in metrical form on the Mandukya Upanishad. Mandukya Upanishad contains only 12 mantras, 12 verses, but this commentary in verse has got 215 verses, which we discussed at length in the Old Temple lecture series. Now, the statement is this: "Sva siddhanta vyavasthasu dvaitino nischita dridham parasparam viruddhyante taihi ayam na viruddhyate." Now, you know why I'm giving you a glimpse into this is an ancient philosophical classic. There is a reason. I said this morning that whatever you find in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna or the teachings of Mother are nothing but condensations or presentations in simple language, the language of our own times, or the great ancient philosophical spiritual wisdom in the Vedas and Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita. That's the point which I want to drive home. See, when we read an old Sanskrit scripture, often it is clothed in the ancient technical language and may be interpreted as views of ancient philosophical systems, schools of thought. But when the same idea is put in the language of a great spiritual teacher who lived close to our own times and who lived a very simple life, apparently, and when she puts this idea in the language of our everyday human interaction, then the relevance becomes much more profound. The meaning is this: susiddhanta vivastasu dvaitino nishchita dritam parasparam viruddhinde taihi ayanna viruddhide. The idea is this: those who hold the view that this my view is right and all other views are wrong, they clash, they fight among themselves. But Advaita Vedanta has no quarrel with anybody, because it looks upon all the different philosophical and spiritual systems of thought as different views embodying the same profound, the same single spiritual truth. And Shankaracharya says, anyone virodhibhi vaidiyoyam dharma na viruddhade atma ananyatvad. All Sanskrit statements, the idea is this: Vedanta looks upon the whole humanity as one spiritual entity, the same Atman residing as the immanent spirit in everything, in everybody. Therefore, there is no otherness. Means atma ananyatva, Atman, Brahman, doesn't see the other, the another. The whole humanity is looked upon as one spiritual entity. That idea, when expressed by Holy Mother, takes the simple form: learn to make the whole world your own. This is the pure Advaita in actual practice. That's why it is said, Holy Mother's teachings, her concept of spirituality, of love, is universal and humanistic. Pure spiritual humanism or spiritual universalism. That's what is found here. Just to give a glimpse of it. Now, I will just read some portions from this book. Some of the disciples and devotees put questions to Mother. Normally, these are the questions that we try to find an answer for ourselves. But Mother gives a very logical, but spiritually very profound and relevant answer, recorded by an anonymous devotee. In fact, this devotee's name is not given. Once I had wanted to take my grandmother on a pilgrimage. So she says, she wanted to take her grandmother on a pilgrimage. But she wanted to know the real significance and meaning of pilgrimage in spiritual life. Pilgrimage plays a very important role, because it's not that God wants you to travel thousands of miles walking, struggling hard, and so God will be very happy if you fast on the day if you don't get enough food. So if you go through all these physical tribulations and trials, God's not necessarily happy. But the point is that the hardships involved in making the pilgrimage will have an impact on our own mind, making our mind a better receptacle for God's grace. So the effect is purely subjective. Once I had wanted to take my grandmother on a pilgrimage, but as the time was inauspicious, she refused to start. Now, you should know a little bit of the Hindu mythology and customs, you know. They often consult an almanac, astrologers, and then they find out a time and appropriate date and time, and day, of course. Day of the week, date according to lunar or solar current system, or what you call paksha, tithi, muhurta, even the auspicious moment to start. Partly we may call it superstition, but that's how this system, this belief can be part of the ancient Hindu social customs. So this grandmother refused to start because the devotee had arranged for the pilgrimage. She had fixed a wrong day or wrong time. So I referred the matter to the Holy Mother for her guidance. So she comes to Holy Mother. Now, you can imagine, I wanted to drive home one idea. Holy Mother is a very conservative, for all practical purposes, traditionally, person, conservative person, coming from a village and not formally educated, the way we understand the word education today, but highly educated in a different sense, of course. I mean, she had the highest spiritual wisdom which modern education cannot offer us. Now, and her instruction is very relevant. She replied, "Son," oh, of course, she went along with her husband, sir, maybe addressing the son, so couple went. "Some say that a man loses the merits he has already earned if he visits a pilgrim center at an inauspicious time, according to astrological calculations, which may be or may not be true." That's not the point here. Now, how mother responds? "But it is wise to perform all holy acts without much delay." Now, if you decide to do something holy and auspicious, it's better not to delay one day or one moment. Better go ahead and do it. Because if you lose an opportunity, you'll be losing an opportunity to do something holy. It's that an opportunity which may not come back again. So mother says, "Don't delay further, go ahead." Mother advised the disciple, these devotees, against conforming to the traditional almanac or customs. I mean, you should wait till an auspicious day and time comes. No. I could not satisfactorily comprehend her meaning. So these devotees couldn't understand, fully understand the meaning. You should not delay further. You start on your pilgrimage straight away without waiting for the auspicious time. So they couldn't understand. So I expressed my doubt to mother once again. I specifically asked her what I should do in my present circumstances. Mother says, "People no doubt say that pilgrimages during inauspicious times are prohibited. One can postpone a holy duty after consideration of time, but look," and then mother says, "death takes no notice of time. Since death has no fixed hours, one should perform holy duties as soon as an opportunity comes." So there's a Sanskrit sloka which comes from Mahabharata, Vidura Vakya, Vidura's instructions. When you feel like doing something good, don't delay. Do it straight away, without wasting time, without delaying for a future opportunity. But when you feel like doing something which is your duty, but well, somewhat unpleasant, which may involve taking a very hard decision, mean a little bit of unpleasantness to others, in that case you wait. So when it is something holy and auspicious, do not wait. When you have to take a decision which may involve some unpleasant consequences, may or may not, well, wait for some time. There's an ancient statement in the Mahabharata. So mother says that when it comes to spiritual practice, which pilgrimage is a spiritual practice, do not wait, do not consult the almanac or the horoscope, and don't analyze the position of the stars and galaxies. But rather, go ahead straight and do it without delay. That's what mother says. So very, you know, you imagine, you throughout mother's life, you find such pearls of wisdom, practical suggestions, which do not contradict scriptures, at the same time, which to some extent make us wake up to certain spiritual truths. That is, when we have to do something auspicious, good and holy, do not wait for appropriate time, date or moment. Go ahead. But when we have to do something which may not necessarily bring desirable results for all, then better wait. That's the idea behind. And mother says, because time takes no notice of death or Kala takes no notice of time. Kala is the lord of death. So there is an ancient statement, we had to perform dharma as if death has caught you by the hair. There's a statement there. Kanasa kanasa seva vidyam artham cha sadhai. Means we must acquire wisdom and knowledge slowly, gradually. It's a very practical suggestion, not necessarily spiritual. Wisdom and wealth, we should not try to acquire all of a sudden, but gradually through constant effort. At the same time, grihideva shiraskena means as if you're caught by death, you're caught by your hair. You don't wait for a minute. You know. So, if we feel that we are caught by death, we are in the jaws of death, or we are caught by the hair, by the lord of death, we must continue performing holy deeds. A very famous statement. Now again, some of the teachings that you find in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna are taken by Holy Mother, and Mother gives appropriate answers. Some disciples, referring to Sri Ramakrishna's teachings, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, presents before Mother some conflicts that we may all feel when we read Sri Ramakrishna's teachings. The disciple is asking Mother, Mother, everybody says that one who approaches the Kalpataru wish-fulfilling tree has to ask for something. Kalpataru is a mythological concept, a tree under which if you stand or sit and ask for something, immediately your desire will be fulfilled. Now, in some of our scriptures, there are statements equating Sri Ramakrishna with Kalpataru. But there is a qualitative difference between the mythological Kalpataru and Sri Ramakrishna interpreted as Kalpataru. In mythological tradition, Kalpataru doesn't bother about your welfare. Whatever you ask, immediately it gives. So it is said, you know, in the gospel there is a interesting story. A person happened to find himself sitting under a Kalpataru, this wish-fulfilling tree. So he was hungry. The story is taken from other scriptures, but Sri Ramakrishna puts in his own language. In Panchatantra, Kadhar Sarisagara, many such ancient mythological stories, this tale is narrated. So a man found himself sitting under a wish-fulfilling tree, a kind of celestial tree, so to speak. And whatever you pray for, whatever desire arises in your mind, the tree fulfills those desires. Those desires may not be always for your good, as you find the story. So a man was very hungry, and he heard about how wonderful it would be if I get an 18-course dinner, so to speak, in modern language. And he got everything. Oh, he was very happy. And then, of course, he had a few more other desires which we need not narrate here. But his final desire is very important. Then the thought crossed his mind. It's not a desire, but, well, how dangerous this is, a deserted forest. If a tiger comes, appears, what will happen? So this idea crossed his mind, a tiger came. And you know what a tiger will do? Now, in the case of Sri Ramakrishna, the interpretation is a bit different. Sri Ramakrishna is a wish-fulfilling tree, but he fulfills only those wishes, desires, which are helpful, which are propitious, conducive to spiritual life. That is the interpretation in the Ramakrishna Mission literature. So that's what the disciple is referring to. Mother, everybody says that one who approaches the Kalpataru, the wish-fulfilling tree, has to ask for something. But I wonder, for what should children ask the mother? No. So mother is also a wish-fulfilling tree. You can approach the mother, you can pray to mother. So a mother gives to every child according to its need. As Sri Ramakrishna used to say, a mother serves different dishes to suit stomachs of her different children. Now, please tell me, which is the correct attitude? Well, that again is a reference to the gospel. Sri Ramakrishna says, God is like mother, the divine mother. Like a housewife, a mother with several children will prepare appropriate food to soothe the digestive capacity of her children. If one child is poor in digestion, she may prepare one item which may be easy to digest, and maybe when she feeds her grown-up healthy son, she may prepare a different food which may not be easy to digest. So like that, if you look upon God as the Divine Mother, and all of us as children with different digestive faculties, the ability to digest different types of food, then we can have different approaches and attitudes with mother. And mother will fulfill whatever needs we have. So, a mother serves different dishes to suit the stomachs of her different children. Now, please tell me, which is the correct attitude? My Holy Mother replies, how much intelligence does a man possess? He is likely to ask for something other than what he really needs. Now, what we need may be different from what we want. What we want to enjoy may be poison in spiritual life, in a spiritual sense. May be wonderful, enjoyable in the worldly sense, but may be poisonous for spiritual life. So the mother doesn't give all that we ask for, because we do not know what we need, and what we may ask for may be just the opposite of what we really need. That conflict is discussed here, and it is very relevant for spiritual seekers. Sometimes we pray for different things, for the fulfillment of different desires. And when we feel that God is not listening to our prayers are not being answered, our desires are not being fulfilled, then we sometimes feel, well, I prayed so much, but nothing will happen. Nothing did happen. So mother says, human intelligence is limited by its very nature. What we ask for may be related to our impulse, our emotions, our mind, which is immature, which may not be pure. And what we need may be totally different from what we all feel that we need. What we all feel that we need may be just the opposite of what we actually are in need of. So the mother says, how much intelligence does a man possess? He is likely to ask for something other than what he really needs. He may even end up creating a monkey in place of Shiva. So that is again a Sanskrit statement, you know. Somebody wanted to make an image out of clay, an image of some deity, but what he finally got was the image of a monkey. So what we ask for may be totally different from what we are in need of. That's why in the Gita, Lord Krishna divides spiritual seekers into four different groups. Artho jijnasu arthaarthi jnani. I mean, there are those who are sick, in need of something miserable, they are in need of some refuge, sick or ill, and they want a remedy for their problems. Then there are those who want something, artharthi. Artha means an instrument or a means for enjoying this world. It could be wealth, it could be money, it could be many other things. These are two primitive categories. Those who turn to God because they are in a state of misery and they feel God will solve the problem. If a person is sick, God will remedy the disease. Fine. By God's grace, your disease may be remedied. Illness may be cured. Like that. Or if a person is poor or in want of something, if you pray to God, God may fulfill his desires. These are two primitive categories. Then there are two higher categories, jnasu and jnani, those who want to know the nature of God. Those are much more evolved. And then finally, those who have really known God and those who really have reached the final destination. So these are the four categories of spiritual seekers that Lord Krishna refers to in the Gita. Now, if you look upon the whole humanity, 7 or 8 billion people, you can place all of them within one or the other categories. I'm talking about those who turn to spirituality, religion, or God. All of them can be placed, can be put under one of these four categories. Now, what happens to those who seek help from God for their illness in a state of utter misery or illness or poverty? God will solve their problem, and then gradually, out of a sense of gratitude that they may feel towards God, who listened to their prayers, who helped them in their state of misery, they may start praying to God without any desire. So first, you pray to God with some desire, and then when God fulfills the desires, you feel a kind of gratitude. So, at the next stage, the same seeker starts praying to God without any desire. And they become inquisitive, jijnasu, and fourth category, they finally reach the highest destination. Now, the point is, there is always a problem for a beginner. We may mistake our real need, and we may rather mix up our real need with our wants, our desires. Our desire and real needs may be mutually contradictory. In that case, we won't have the intelligence, the wisdom, the discerning faculty to ask for the right thing, the right kind of help. So there is one way out. So mother says, it is wise to take refuge in Him, H capital. So it's better to take refuge in God. So once you take refuge in God, then God's will start to function through us. Then our will, our mind, our intellect will get linked to God. So whatever we think, or whatever we do, whatever we speak, will be somehow linked to the idea of God. So that is the advantage of taking shelter at God's feet. So mother says, it is wise to take refuge in Him. So if you sincerely take refuge in God, then, and if you do that sincerely, with all honesty and earnestness, then the fact that we have taken refuge in God will always be in our mind. The idea that we are acting on behalf of God, that whatever we do is linked to God, will be always present in our mind. So that will slowly spiritualize our actions, deeds and words. This idea is put in the Bhagavad Gita, what Lord Krishna describes in the four verses, 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th verses of 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Bhakti Yoga. You find these four verses describe in a descending order four levels of taking refuge in God, which is what Mother is speaking about here. So the chapter is 12th chapter, Bhakti Yoga, the Yoga of Devotion, verses 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th. 8th one is, Mayyeva mana adhatsva, mayi buddhim nivesaya, nivasi shasi mayyeva ata udham nasamsaya, athachittam samadhadam nasaknoshi mayi sthiram, abhyasa yogena tato, mamichhaptam dhananjaya. That is the 9th verse. Abhyasepi asamarthosi matkarma paramobhava, madartham abhikarmani kurvan siddhimavapsi. That is the 11th verse. Atha edadabhi ashaktosi kartum madhyogam asidaha sarva karma phalatyagam tatakuru yatatma. This is the 12th verse. So 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th, sorry. 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th verse. This is four verses. Maybe when I counted. So the first one is this, the highest state of spiritual surrender, which is described in the 8th verse of the 12th chapter, where Lord Krishna says, the highest devotee is one who has surrendered his intellect. Mayyeva mana adharsva, mayi buddhim nivesaya. Intellect and mind completely surrendered to God. Such a devotee lives in God, and God lives in the mind of that devotee. Mean that God Himself starts residing in the heart of the devotee. That is the 8th verse. Now, this is the highest state of surrender. And if you attain this level of surrender, then God starts residing in you, and you start residing in God. In the 9th verse, an alternate option is given. This highest level of surrender may not be easy. So how to reach that state? So the Lord Krishna says, Atha chittam samadhadum ne shaknoshi mai sthiram abhyasa yogena tado maam ichhaptan dhananjaya. 9th verse. If you cannot always surrender your mind and intellect completely on God, then abhyasa yoga means repeat. When you hear, try to hear about God. When you see, try to see things that remind you of God. When you speak, try to speak things that remind you of God. When you remember the memory, let that memory be helpful in spiritual life. So, Sravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasim, Sakhyam, Atmanivedanam. Ninefold method of surrender or the highest devotion is mentioned in the Bhagavata Purana. Listening, then praising the Lord, then remembering God, then worshipping God, then doing service in the name of God, and then considering use of the servant of God, considering use of the friend of God, and finally trying to surrender yourself to God. It's a ninefold method of surrender. So if you practice this slowly, your mind and intellect will start residing in God, and God also will start residing in you. But then the option given in the ninth verse also not easy. This also is not an easy path to practice. In such a case, Lord Krishna says, do whatever duty you have to do, but consider that work as God's work, not your work. That is the 10th verse. The Abhyasepi asamarthosi matkarma paramo bhava madartham abhikarmani kurvan siddhim avapsyasi. So if you cannot practice this remembrance and so on, then do your duty, but within your mind you should have this idea, well, this is not my work, it's the Lord's work. You find this idea is stressed again and again in many of the Christian mystical autobiographical writings. Euphilo Kalia, Brother Lawrence, Saint Teresa of Avila, Inner Warfare, many such classics you find. Mostly in the writings of the Russian mystical classics you find. Again and again. Of course, along with that, they have the practice of repeating their own mantra, some kind of statement. But anyhow, the idea of looking upon whatever we do, whatever we speak, whatever we think as God's work, not our work, is the third option that Krishna gives. And there's a last and fourth option. And that is, if we cannot look upon your action as God's action, your work as God's work, matkarma paramo bhava, that's the third option. If you can't do that, then do your duty, but mentally surrender the results of whatever you do to God. Give up your desire for the results of your actions. Sarva karma phalatyagam. That's the fourth option. Now, that's why Mother says it is wise to take refuge in Him. So, once we make an attempt to take refuge in God, then what happens? God's will starts functioning through us. Slowly, we graduate, we evolve to the status of God's instrument, an instrument in God's hands. And then what? An instrument doesn't revolt, you know. If an instrument declares autonomy, then you cannot do anything. You write with a pen or a pencil. If the pencil asserts its autonomy, independence, declaration of independence, not possible. Suppose you start writing a letter with a pencil or a pen, the pen should be completely in a state of surrender to your will. If that pen or pencil starts drafting declaration of independence, then you cannot write anything. Similarly, when we surrender ourselves completely to Lord's will, then God's will starts functioning through us. This is the secret of all great spiritual teachers of the world, including the greatest Advaita teachers also. So Advaita and non-dualism and devotion, these are not mutually contradictory. They are two different approaches to the same spiritual goal. So that's why Mother says, how much intelligence does a man possess? Not much. That's why intellect sometimes puts you in a trap, and we should be very careful. One great danger in practical spiritual life is when we read a book, when we become familiar with an idea, we delude ourselves into thinking that we have reached that experience, but actually it's only a concept or an idea. I have seen this among many spiritual seekers, well-educated spiritual seekers, maybe too well-educated for their own spiritual comfort. So what really happens is, when we read great philosophical books, Adhyatma Ramayana, this Ashtavakra Gita, and then Shankaracharya's commentaries, without the guidance of a master or a teacher, I am Brahman, you are Brahman, nothing much to do then. Everything is Brahman, Brahman is everywhere, God is everywhere, I am also essentially God, and nothing much to do here. Why should there be a retreat? Why should we read books? No prayer, nothing. Now, this logic can be used by Hitler also. And mind you, this logic was used by great demons of in Hindu mythology. There were many great demons who used this logic. I can give an example which is a bit funny, but a lot deep message behind. There's a story of Bhasmasura. Now this was a demon, an evil fellow, but he had plenty of grit and determination and willpower, so he did tapasya, he did penance for a long time. And he prayed to Shiva. Now Shiva naturally appeared. And Shiva felt, this fellow, maybe he has worshipped me, he has meditated upon me, he prayed to me for so long, I must do something for him. So this evil demon extracted a boon from Shiva. The boon was, Shiva did not imagine that his devotee will ask for such a wonderful boon. So he was a bit shocked. So the boon that he asked for was this: on whosoever head I place my hand, that fellow should die immediately. That was the boon he asked for. Shiva, perhaps he was not in a, you know, he was in an unguarded moment. He had given this promise and he had to keep his word. It's all right. Then the demon wanted to test on his own guru the effect of the boon. So he tried to place his hand on Shiva's head to test on the guru himself. And Shiva didn't expect this much from him. And he went helter-shelter and demon chasing him all around. And then finally Shiva was a bit straightforward. And Vishnu was equally great, maybe greater, but was sufficiently shrewd, who could see through the game of these demons, you know. So Shiva went to Vishnu, and Vishnu said, I shall solve the problem. So the demon reached Vishnu and was about to place his hands upon his head. But Vishnu was shrewd enough to evade, you know. So Vishnu was laughing. Then this demon, you know, every evil man has got an Achilles heel, some serious weak point. That's how God's will works, you know. Otherwise they will destroy the whole world. So even the wickedest fellows will have one strong weak point. Strong weak point means very fatal weak point. It's a fatal Achilles heel, so to speak. So he was a bit dull and stupid, this demon. So Vishnu told him, look here, I have never seen a fool like you. I have seen many fools, but nobody like you. Do you imagine that Shiva could give you a boon like this? He will say all this, but this is not going to work. The demon tried to argue, or tried to test on your own head, and I can show you it's not going to work. And the demon put his hand on his own head, and he died. Now the point is this, sometimes you know what happens, our intellect can put us in a trap. We sometimes may chase an idea, read in a book, in a lecture we may suddenly be impressed when we listen to a great idea. Then what happens? we may delude ourselves into thinking that this idea is a matter of real experience to us. But actually, it is only a concept or an idea. It is not an experience. This concept or idea should become real spiritual experience. Then only it helps us. Now, the point is, sometimes when we read great philosophical books, we may be deluded. We will swept off our feet by the wonderful philosophical argument. And then we may delude ourselves into thinking that is really we have reached that level in reality. But it is only a concept, an idea. That's all. In fact, that intellectual idea will not give us the intelligence to understand where we stand. That's why Mother says, how much intelligence does a man possess? Intelligence here doesn't mean intellectual power. Real faculty, discerning mind, that's what Mother says. The discerning mind comes only when a great spiritual idea becomes a spiritual experience. There's a great, wide gap between a spiritual concept and a spiritual experience. A spiritual concept or a spiritual idea is at a high level, intellectual level. Mind may be at a very low level. So there is a great gap between where the intellect stands and the mind stands. So Mother says, unless this becomes some kind of an experience, it will not help us to have the intelligence, to have the discerning mind, to pray for what we actually are in need of. We may pray for something that we may have a desire for, but that may be totally different from what we are actually in need of. So the conflict that often arises in our mind in spiritual life is due to a lack of capacity to understand this difference. A concept and an idea on the one hand, real experience not there. In terms of real experience, we may belong to a lower level. But we may have read wonderful books. Books may impress us. But that impression doesn't raise the mind to a higher level. To raise the mind to a higher level, we need to practice. Because we all live at mental level, not intellectual level. All normal human beings live at the mental level. So mind should be raised to the level of ideas that the intellect grasps. That's why Mother says, normally we don't have much discerning faculty. We don't have so much of intelligence. So we may perhaps pray for something that may not be what we need. We may try to imitate Bhasmasura the wrong way. Praying for something, it may bring destruction to others, destruction to ourselves. This often, that's the burden of the great mythological stories throughout the Hindu mythological works like Ramayana, Mahabharata, all the Puranas are full of demons who worked very hard, did a lot of penance, propitiated different deities and got miraculous powers, destructive powers, with broad destruction on themselves and also on others. That's why Mother says it is wise to take refuge in Him, in God. Once we take refuge in God, then what happens? God's will take the place of our will. Or our will gets linked to God's will. This is the classic example in the life of Sri Ramakrishna. The case of this Girishandra Ghosh, who was a profligate, a drunkard, an alcoholic, a man who led a bohemian life, but he had strong will, willpower, and integrity. He never promised to do something he knew very well he cannot do. So he went to Sri Ramakrishna. He wanted spiritual training, enlightenment. I won't go into the full story, there's no time. But Sri Ramakrishna found that this fellow had one good quality. He was sincere, honest. He was a bohemian, he was an alcoholic, he was a drunkard, leading a very loose life. But when Sri Ramakrishna told him, well, you try to pray in the morning and evening, he said, well, I don't know when I wake up in the morning. He's a drunkard. A drunkard and also the highest spiritual persons, they both transcend time. See, the highest spiritual personalities live at the level of infinity. Because time, space, causation, they all spiritually elevated souls, they transcend this relativity, time, space and causation. So this man openly said, well, he can't give word, he can't promise that he would pray in the morning and evening. Then once a day, while going to bed, he said, no, he can't give word. So Sri Ramakrishna understood, he's sincere. Then Sri Ramakrishna told him, you give your power of attorney to me, meaning complete surrender, responsibility. You give whole responsibility for your spiritual progress to me, which means complete surrender. He didn't realize, Girishandra Ghosh did not realize what really meant, but he agreed immediately. And from that moment onwards, it became physically and psychologically impossible for him to do anything bad. He could not drink anymore. He could not lead a loose bohemian life any longer. And gradually, he began to evolve. Eventually, he became a great saint who recognized Sri Ramakrishna as an incarnation of God. That's the story. So the point is this, it is wise to take refuge in God. Which means, once you take refuge in God, at the beginning, you get linked to God's will. Your will gets linked to God's will. A connecting thread, you are integrated, your little willpower personality is integrated into the cosmic personality of God. At the highest level, God's will starts functioning through you. You become an instrument in God's hands, which is stated in the Gita, Nimitta Matram Bhava Savyasachin. Lord Krishna says as last ultimatum, say last option, Lord Krishna tells Arjuna in the Gita, you try to be an instrument in hands of God. So it's wise to take refuge in God. He will always give you whatever is necessary, whatever you are in need of, not whatever you want. That's what Mother implies here. However, one should pray for devotion and desirelessness. For such a prayer does no harm. In Swami Vivekananda's Bhakti Yoga lectures, Swamiji elaborates on this point. We must try to sublimate our desire. It may not be easy for spiritual seekers to all of a sudden become desireless. Because some kind of plan, desire, scheme, all these are part of daily human endeavor, activities. So can we really become totally desireless all of a sudden? No. But to begin with, we must try to sublimate, elevate our desire to a higher level. And that will finally take us to a stage where we become completely desireless. That's the idea behind. Disciple, referring to Sri Ramakrishna's statement, says, the master said, those who come here will be in their last embodiment. Again, Swamiji said, none can have liberation without complete renunciation. What then will be the fate of householders? So, two statements are taken. One from Sri Ramakrishna, another from Swamiji. Both are mutually complementary, not contradictory. But any ordinary spiritual seeker reading these statements may feel like asking these questions. We'll discuss this subject maybe tomorrow. And now we'll have interaction for almost 30 minutes, so we can discuss the subject.
Swami, I have a question. This thing of not finding fault with anybody, if a nation tries to implement that, they will have to open all the jails, suspend all the police force, suspend all the judicial system, all the criminals will be on the street, and the country will be doomed. So it is just a utopia, you know, this not finding fault.
Before using that term, I will come. I will try to explain that point. It really, mother is here speaking not about national idea. She is speaking about how about practicing a spiritual sadhana, which is essentially an individual effort. See, when we talk about desirelessness, when we talk about ahimsa, for example, when we talk about liberation, moksha, we are not talking about nations, civilizations, or even congregations. See, the one central point to remember, in Vedantic or Hindu tradition, the idea of congregational liberation is totally absent. Spiritual life is basically an individual-centered endeavor. Very often, giving an example, to what extent an individual spiritual ideal can be misunderstood to be the policy of a nation. Ahimsa, for example, non-violence, which Gandhi preached. It is not in Hinduism. What Gandhiji meant was the idea of non-violence preached in the Mahabharata, in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, as an individual spiritual sadhana, should be implemented as a national policy for the nation's independent struggle. So Gandhi makes it very clear. Sometimes what happens, you know, many of these ideas like truthfulness, purity, or asceticism, desirelessness, all these great spiritual ideas, we may try to interpret as national policies. Totally wrong. It is an individual spiritual sadhana. Individual spiritual sadhana. In Vedantic tradition, is an individual who realizes moksha. See, when Jesus spoke about you going to kingdom of heaven, did he really mean that the whole congregation or whole nation, whole population marching towards kingdom of heaven? Is the individual spiritual progress. Spirituality is always at the individual level. Religion may be at the congregational or national level, but spirituality is always at individual level. When we try to practice this desirelessness at the spiritual level, we are purifying our own inner life. It is not for nation, not at all. So, it is not at all utopia. It is very realistic. In fact, all these teachings are found, most of these teachings are found in all world religious classics. Total unselfishness. Jesus Christ, you give everything behind you and follow me. What does it mean? Same idea, desirelessness. Unselfishness. So, aparigraha, Patanjali language. Same idea. So, all these spiritual ideas are essentially at the individual level, not at the national or even congregational level. Even we discuss number of spiritual devotees coming together in retreat. For what? When spiritual seekers come together, our individual spiritual life gets enriched. When in a small hall, about 40 or 50 spiritual seekers discuss or listen to spiritual ideas, a great vibration is created, which has an enriching effect, an elevating, a sublimating effect on the minds of the people. But then, real spiritual progress takes place at the individual level, not at the national level. This should be understood very clearly. Liberation, moksha, spiritual enlightenment all take place at the individual level. See, we close our eyes and meditate. What does it mean? We are turning inward. We are not staring at external world. Rather, we are closing, which means we are looking inward. When we look inward, we close our eyes. When we look outward, you stare. You open your eyes. So that's why we meditate. we become introspective, we pray. When we pray also, you try to close your eyes, which means you are opening the inner door within. So, the point is this, the simple answer is, this desirelessness, purity, asceticism, non-violence, truthfulness, all these great spiritual disciplines are recommended for individuals, not for nations or societies like that. That should be understood.
You were saying that God is like mother and serves the food depending upon the child's digestion.
Yeah.
So, like little children do get cancer. That like all those bad stuff. Is that God's will? Does God want? Does God give us because they don't have good? They have good digestion.
Well, you know, when you want me to go back to analogy, in that little children, if they fall sick, the medicine that they get is God's will that enables them to get medicines. So there is an inherent integrating scheme. If you ask the question, if God is so fine, so kind-hearted, why should there be cancer at all? Why can't there be perfect peace and happiness, everything all right? That's the question. That is a purely ontological question. We're asking the question, why at all is this creation?
At
the same time, if you're coming back to the story here, I want to come back to the story, not the ontological question. Coming back to the story in discussion, if a child gets sick, then a mother naturally goes to a doctor, takes the child to Kaiser. Okay. It is the divine motherly element in that mother who takes the child to the doctor. Because the child at that time is in need of medicine, not heavy food. On the other hand, if there is a healthy grown-up man, the grown-up man needs another kind of food for his sustenance. So, here a loving mother plays the role of the divine mother of the world, universe. And God, therefore, takes care of everybody. The diversity of human temperaments, the plurality, the multiplicity of human needs in spiritual life are explained with the help of this analogy. See, you, for example, may be very active. A person may be a very active person. He wants to practice karma yoga. One may be of an intellectual turn of mind. He may practice jnana yoga. Another person may be an emotional type. He wants to pray to God. Well, why should God create these four different paths? Because different human beings belong to different temperaments. Different human beings are like different types of children, small children, who have different faculty of digestion and therefore need different types of food. So, plurality or multiplicity of different spiritual needs and temperaments are explained, described, in the light of this analogy. That's the idea behind. Thank you. No, coming to you.
Swami, not finding fault with others, in practice, whether we like it or not, our minds have been trained very differently, whether we like it or not, we see it, whether we say it or not. So in implementation, what's mother really meaning by saying don't see faults?
Well, you know, after mother, he is here presenting the highest spiritual ideal. Now, if we can keep this highest spiritual ideal in our mind, the horizon, then perhaps the tendency to find fault, even when there is no fault at all, that could be reduced. So very often when we keep a high ideal in the mental horizon, slowly we unconsciously move towards realizing that ideal, at least in part, to some extent. It is very difficult to live in this world without finding some mistake somewhere. But maybe the tendency to find fault everywhere beyond a limit where there is no fault at all these undesirable tendencies can be reduced and gradually eliminated if we keep this great teaching in mind. So universal love, you know, as I said, a universal love is mentioned. So we can't say that we can immediately start practicing mother's highest spiritual ideal, but that should be kept in mind. That's ideally. Yes. That's why, you know, a mother never finds fault with even her criminal son. Maybe these days they do that, perhaps, you know. But they are not supposed to do that. You see, if at all, if there is one human relationship that transcends all these limitations, it is the relationship between mother and child. That's the idea behind it. So, and in Shankaracharya's Stotra, Matru Panchakam is mentioned there, because mother bears the child for 10 months in her womb, so that's an obligation that the child can never pay back the debt. Even the criminal's child cannot do that. That's the idea behind. So, mother has given a part of her food, her sustenance, for the life of the little child, which the father does not worry about. That's why the relationship between the child and mother is totally inseparable. And this is stressed in innumerable scriptures also. Purest and most intimate. So that's why only a mother can stop finding fault with her children who may be punished by the father. But mother may not do that. That's the idea. That's the idea.
So if you, to make it something perfect, to make a perfect organization or to make something very perfect, if you can't find flaws, and then how can you make something perfect?
Oh, you mean to correct somebody, to find fault? What do you mean? To correct, improve, to help somebody?
Suppose if I'm making a part,
yes.
Or my child is making a part.
I think when mother said about finding fault, she didn't mean a friend trying to correct his or her friend. See, if you are going towards a precipice, if a friend tries to stop you, mother didn't mean that friend should not stop you, go ahead. No. So the implication is very simple. So, mother didn't mean that, no, you as a friend, you should not stop your friend from falling over the precipice. The idea is this, finding fault as an obsession, when it becomes a pathological obsession, you know, that should not be practiced, as mother says. Okay. And if you do proofreading, mother didn't say you should not do proofreading, you know. Even this book also is proofread by people. So that's all, sir. That's all. So you should not literally interpret all these statements beyond the spirit. The spirit should be kept in mind. Oh, please.
So auspicious actions and timing. What Devi says about, you know, if you feel it, do it, because you may not have another time. Makes sense, but almost all Hindu rites are related
to the Christian time. Yes, you know. Now, astrology, Vedic astrology, is essentially a system of mathematics and science based upon the study of the position of stars and galaxies and planets. So, a genuine astrologer will always tell you, but this is what the... It's pure mathematics, mind you. This is what the calculations tell us. But beyond this is God's will. If an astrologer does not tell you that finally everything depends upon God's will, he is not a genuine astrologer. Every genuine astrologer will admit the limitation of astrology. One important characteristic of astrology is that a genuine astrologer has to practice certain spiritual practices. So he will be initiated in the mantra, which has to do. He is invariably instructed by his guru. I am talking about tradition. I am not talking about the advertisements that you find in newspapers. You know, I am talking about genuine astrology. It's very difficult to find a genuine astrologer, but there are still many great astrologers who will tell you, well, this is what the calculations tell us. But beyond this, there is God's will. So astrology is related to the idea of predetermination and result of karma, karma phala. But a great astrologer, when he talks about parihara, parihara means the remedial measures to be taken to solve a problem, he will tell you, finally, you can pray to God, things will change. It's like an arrow that is left above, it flies towards its object. It has to hit the object because the velocity should come to, velocity will force the arrow to hit the object because it has left the bow. But then suppose a strong wind blows, the arrow falls down. Its velocity is affected. So God's grace is a strong wind that blows, which directs the, which gives a new direction to the arrow that is flying. That is, you know, this idea comes from Shankaracharya himself in his Bhashya, who is a non-dualist. He's talking about Isha Anugriha Deva Pumsam Dveda Vasana. It comes in the Avadhuta Gita, but it comes in many other Advaitic works also. The point is this, God's grace can finally correct, or it can supersede your astrology. Otherwise, you know, everything is predetermination. If you believe in astrology, then you have no business to believe in God and spirituality. Astrology reduces you to fatalism if it is not properly understood. Astrology is not fatalism. It is pure science and mathematics. The real, genuine character of true science is it understands its own limitation. So every great astrologer will admit its limitations. That's the point to be remembered.
In reading some of the books from Ramakrishna publication, I forgot the book's names. So the some of the Swamiji's discourages astrology completely.
Now, oh yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yes, true. No, Swamiji discourages astrology in one context, one or two contexts. The reason is, the astrology was sometimes misinterpreted as predetermination and fatalism, and kind of blind faith and instant predetermination, which will make a society effeminate. I mean, which completely kill your instinct for self-effort. So there Swamiji strongly discourages. But Swamiji recognized the place of this ancient science in many contexts. Astrology sometimes is misinterpreted as fatalism, and sometimes become fraud and quackery and all those things. I don't want to blame a science or its practitioners, but the idea is this: every genuine astrologer will tell you that God's will supersedes the conclusions of astrology. Otherwise, you are reducing the whole human life to predeterministic dimension. You know, there is no place in it for anything else. Everything is predetermined. That will take us to a very primitive concept of life.
Is it meant for only psychological boost?
It can't be, because Vedic astrology was evolved. It was developed to find the appropriate time for the performance of yajnas and yagas, Vedic rituals, fire rituals. So the correct time and all the things. It had its place, but many of these ancient sciences are sometimes misinterpreted, and many quacks and fakes have emerged, you know, practically with give a bad name to everything else as astrology also. So,
all our marriages are determined by
yes. No, that's why now that's again a social custom. Yeah. Here I'm focusing on astrology as one of the Vedangas, one of the six limbs of Vedas. So there it is described as a science for finding out the right time and date and moment for the performance of Vedic rituals. So it's a science. That's why I tell you, to understand whether it's genuine or not, you ask a real astrologer. If it tells, he give me $100, I shall solve all the problems, don't go near him. But if it tells, well, this is a science, it has its own limitations. It has its own genuineness also. Then you can believe in him. The test of genuineness is when the person realizes or admits its limitation. If you tell me you are an omniscient, you know everything, it means you know nothing. But if you tell me you know you are an engineer, you don't know much about medicine, then I will believe that you are a good engineer. That's the idea. So that holds good for all ancient sciences also.
Swami, mother also said that everything happens by the will of the God. Will of the God.
No.
So it's predestined then, everything.
Yes, that mother gives that advice, but mother also told the disciples and devotees to continue practicing spiritual, to pray. Why should you pray if everything is decided and everything is put under lock and key? Then where's the place for prayer and spiritual practices? So mother repeatedly tells her disciples and devotees to continue praying to God, continue spiritual practices. And not only that, mother tells that God's grace can reduce the intensity of what you are predestined to enjoy or suffer. If you are destined to be bitten by a cobra, you may be bitten by a water snake if you pray to God. I am just trying to put it in today's language. If you are destined to be bitten by a water snake, maybe an ant may bite you. But it doesn't create any problem for you. So the intensity will be reduced. That's by the grace of God. I told you just now, you see, it is predetermination means prarabdha. And the arrow has left the bow. Will of God, predetermination, it has a velocity, so left by itself, it will hit the targets. But suppose by the time a strong wind blows, or tornado, then what happens, you know, the flight of the direction of the arrow will be changed. It will be diverted towards a new direction. It may fall down. So it won't hit you. Similarly, whatever you are predestined to enjoy or suffer will be affected by your spiritual practice. That's one mother said. Yes, including prarabdha karma, everything. Prarabdha karma will be affected by the grace of God. Agami karma doesn't arise because you have become a spiritual seeker. Sanjita karmas will be wiped out when you reach the highest spiritual enlightenment. That's the idea.
Maharaj, or infinite
Swami,
you finishing?
No, 5-7 minutes more.
So, I have a question on the second part of Mother's saying, make everybody your own. So, I just wanted to hear from you. On the third visit of M to Thakur Ramakrishna, he advised that think everybody is Hari, not mine.
you know, stay detached, you know.
So, oh, yeah.
So this too.
Right, right. Yes, yes, yes. You know, Guru Sri Ramakrishna knew very well Yam's background. See, Yam was a person who was on the verge of committing suicide. And because of the domestic problems in a joint family with all the problems, he left his home at midnight, accompanied by his wife, reached Siddheshwara Majumdar's place. And next day, he went to the Dakshineswar. So, Sri Ramakrishna knew the whole problem, Yam's background. So he knew that Yam mentally, Yam has a serious problem of excessive attachment towards his kith and kin, which was standing in the way of his further spiritual progress. So, Sri Ramakrishna was giving a medicine for him to cure that disease. So, what he was in need of was a dose of detachment. That's the idea behind. But remember, when Hazra, who was not a great spiritual soul, who was pretending to be practicing detachment, running away from his duties and responsibilities, not looking after his mother, his parents and his wife, Sri Ramakrishna tried to drive him out, away from Dakshineswar, go and look after your wife and parents, see? So how do you reconcile this? Sri Ramakrishna asks Yam to practice detachment and he tells Hazra to practice attachment in the form of dutifulness. You should do his duty and responsibility as a married man. So because he was running away from his duties and responsibilities. So Sri Ramakrishna gave one medicine to Azra, another medicine to Yam. He was a doctor who gave the right type of medicine to the patients who came to him.
And mother's medicine was from
Advaita. Exactly. Yes, you see. So, I think we have 4 minutes more. So anything else? Would you explain?
So back to the fault.
Please don't forget. Tomorrow you can repeat the same question. In Ignambi, you can continue this discussion. Tomorrow we have one more session. Please continue. Oh, please come.
So back to the fault thing. The psychologists would say the faults you see in others are really your own projection.
Psychologist
would say that if you see faults in others, it's your own projection, which means it's your fault.
True.
So Sarada Devi makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah,
that way.
Really, yes.
Because they may be doing really well from their point of view.
That's true. That's true.
No,
that's true.
Point of view, that is bad.
Yes, but on the one hand, it is a very sound psychological view. On the other hand, it's a great ideal of spiritual universalism, spiritual humanism. But then, often we feel, can we live in the world without finding fault anywhere? So the implication is that there are many people who do it to an excessive level, excessive extent, too much of finding fault with others. So mother said that will degenerate all of us. So. See, the mother's concept of universal love is reflected in this instruction. You wanted to ask something?
You know, this morning you were saying something about if you work 8 hours and then you go you try to meditate, you know, the during the day you have all these impressions. I was kind of wondering if you are a policeman, or that sort of a thing, where you see everything is not right, you go through that whole day. How do you, I mean, you can think about God, but, you know, there is so much more intensity there.
That's true when we do a work, but then if we can look upon it this way, well, this is a duty that God has given to me. This is the work which I am given. What about people serving the military, for example? So this is the work that God has given to me. But I do this duty properly. And then that's why in the Gita statement, Matkarma, which is God's work, not my work. So everyone has to do her or his allotted duty and responsibility. And it's not that one duty is bad, another is good. In fact, a priestly work can also be a selfish work. A policeman work also can be a kind of worship, depending upon the attitude. Work can become worship, and worship can become work. So mechanically, if you do worship, it becomes work. Spiritually, if you do work, it becomes worship. So if we can keep this ideal in mind, at least as an intellectual concept, slowly you will find mind moving towards this realization.
How do you prevent yourself from having those impressions? I can think, I guess eventually by the time I really get there, it would be a wonderful thing. But during the initial phases, how do you prevent yourself for not getting those impressions? You know, you see the horrible things and you...
That's true. Well, at the end of the day, if you again just look upon all the work that you have done that day as your duty, which God has given you, which you did to the best of your ability, without neglecting your duty, that's enough. In a way, the ultimate analysis is the way we look upon things, the mind that is the crucial element in deciding all this. So if we can look upon the whole thing as the duty which I did, as my swadharma, my allotted responsibility, duty, that attitude will remove many of the conflicts and problems. Look at Arjuna. Lord Krishna did not ask Arjuna to stop fighting. See, ma manusmara yudhyecha. So mean, think of me and then fight. Think of me and sit in a cave. No. Think of me and then fight. Lord Krishna, Arjuna's position was not different from that of a policeman. Soldier. Not a very pleasant duty. So, Lord Krishna tells him, well, you do all this, but as my instrument. Nimitta matram bhava sarvesajan. Many of these ideas are preached by Krishna, who was himself a soldier, to another soldier, Arjuna. So, I think ultimately, if we can develop this attitude, that will solve many of the conflicts, inner conflicts we face. So, we will continue this discussion tomorrow, 10 o'clock again. So, Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ram Krishna. Thank you.